From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer here at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, and I'm with Dan Schwartz, co-host here, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Stanford.
Hello, Denise.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. So I'm very excited. We're going to be talking about parenting, and I have a study that I want to describe to you and see if you can predict how it ended.
Okay. Dan loves to stump me. I'm a little nervous, but okay, I'm game. Well, I'm game.
So this one, it takes a couple of left turns, so have patience with me.
I will be patient.
So it comes out of the question of why all mammals play. So mammals play, all of them, and humans play. And everybody's trying to figure out why do they play. Now, you can't really do studies on humans about this because it's not like you can take a bunch of kids and put them in a closet for 5 years and say, don't play.
That would be cruel and unusual punishment, yes.
But we do it with rats.
Okay.
So rats really like to play. So here's the study. They take juvenile male rats and they keep them in cages. And for 1 hour, half of the rats get to put in the center cage with other juvenile rats and they play like crazy. They just leap in. They're super excited, you know, yay, and they play. The other half they put with the mother. And the mothers don't really want to play with the juveniles, so they just groom and bond for an hour. And they do this over a couple of weeks. Then they look at them about 3 months later. So what do you think the difference is between rats who only get to play versus rats that only get to be with their mother?
I think it's like mama boy rats. Like if you're,
mama boy rats.
If you're only with your mother, you don't know how to be not with your mom, maybe? Is that?
You think they know how to cook?
I think, yeah, right. It goes to like, it's like finishing school. You learn how to cook and do the chores and all. No, I think the rats who play are healthier. That would be my guess. I don't really know why, but that would be my guess.
Right. So they turn out to be more socially adjusted, less fearful, quicker to recover. And so it's an interesting question why this is happening. And one thought is if you let the rats play with each other, it's kind of aggressive. And so they learn when they get nipped that this doesn't mean they're supposed to fight back. Or they learn not to hit too hard, and they know how to make better bids and interact. So getting this chance to play gives you this great social experience. Being mothered the whole time makes you fearful because you're afraid to go out and you don't know how to interact with other people because your mom was always there.
So it's fascinating, too, that the rats, you know, I always think of the rats going in and playing without, let's say, an adult present. How do you know they're not going to hurt one another? Like, you know, there's no – I'm thinking this as a mom now, right?
Yeah.
So there would be this sort of fear. It's almost like Lord of the Flies, like let the kids loose and they're going to end up hurting one another. But it sounds like that doesn't happen, or you learn to deal with a little bit of rough and tumble, or
– Well, they're not giant rats. You know, they're pup rats, and they're just learning and they're playing like dogs. You want dogs to learn to play with each other so they don't develop fear aggression. So the question here is this a fair analogy for parents who are helicopter parents? Are they preventing their children from experiencing the world and learning to cope with difficulties, but also make social bids where it's a little awkward and you're trying to figure out how to get started?
So, and I love that term. I love and hate that term, helicopter parent, right? So if folks haven't heard that before, if you think of a helicopter, it swoops in and rescues. It hovers, right, and then swoops in and rescues. I have also been on the East Coast where they call them snow plow parents, right? Because you plow the snow and let's move everything out of the way. Let's move all the danger out of the way, and we make a nice, easy path for you to get through life, right? So helicopter and snow plow.
So are parents doing this because they're protecting their child or because they want to lead their child's life? So like I had a friend who had an infant in the carriage, and I would sort of reach in and go boo, 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 to the infant. And the mother would put her head between me and the infant and respond for the infant. So I never actually got to interact with the infant. I would interact with the mother who was sort of going boo, 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 back to me.
Oh, my. First of all, just thinking about that, I wish I had a video camera seeing you. Just actually hearing you go boo, boo, boo right now was probably worth it just for that. That is hysterical. And also a real problem, as we know from our guest who's here with us today. So we are really excited to have Julie Lithcott-Hames, personal friend of mine, 10 years as the dean of freshmen at Stanford. She's no longer at Stanford, but she'd served for 10 years as the dean of freshmen, and New York Times bestselling author of How to Raise an Adult. So we are really lucky to have Julie here with us today.
Welcome.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Julie, you spent 10 years...
We're not going to talk about the rats.
Go ahead.
If you want to comment on the rats, you can. You can't.
I'm listening to this like, we actually are putting children in a cage for 5 years. It's called childhood.
Yeah.
It's a cage for 18 years. And we're actually conducting that study without knowing it. We are putting kids in a cage of enrichment and instead of letting them play freely. And they are having these outcomes that you report the rats are having. This is the perfect analogy. It's the perfect research. I'm so delighted you mentioned it.
Well, we're glad. So let's talk about when you were at Stanford and you were dean of freshmen, what kind of behavior did you see that led you to end up writing a book called How to Raise an Adult?
So, you know, we use these funny terms, snowplow parenting, helicopter parenting. They call it drone parenting down in Palos Verdes.
Oh, my gosh.
You can hear the drone. I've isolated three types of behavior. There's the overprotection. The world is scary and unsafe and unpredictable. Therefore, I must always be there to prevent anything from happening to my kid rather than prepare them. There's overdirection, which is you will follow my course of action, kid, and my love for you might be conditioned upon the extent to which you do. And there's the excessive handholder or the concierge who just wants to be utterly helpful at all times in the life of a kid. How can I make your childhood easier, honey? That kind of thing. So at Stanford, I saw these types of overparenting play out. The overprotective parent would be the parent who would call us in the advising office and say, I haven't heard from my daughter in a day. I'm worried. I need to know that she's all right. You know, well, I'm sure she's fine, sir, but we can have someone check. Please don't tell her I called. I know she's there. The blue dot is showing me she's there on your campus, but she just won't respond to my phone call. And you found yourself going, I wonder why.
Well, wait. Can we talk about that for a second? So this is someone who's 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. They had the test scores and the smarts to get into Stanford University. They are away from home. And they have a parent allegedly miles away, right, who calling to check up on them.
Yeah. So
I know why. The parents have sacrificed their whole life for this child. It's a huge investment. They want to make sure their kid's doing what they're supposed to be doing.
And they've always monitored them to this point, so how can they stop now?
Aha. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
The second type of the example, sort of the overdirective, this is the kid who's kind of the pre-med kid because their parents say they have to become a doctor. So I would work with students who were just biding their time to get into med school, to get the MD, so that they could then summon the courage to say to their parent, I don't actually want to be a doctor. And the third type, you know, is the concierge, the parent who's still editing their child, quote unquote, papers and work, even though the child is now in college. Just how can I be useful? How can I perfect your path? You know, the parent that wants to argue with the faculty member over the grade the parent's not happy with, just as they always have in childhood.
So you had parents actually call up faculty members and say, what?
Well, I heard that anecdotally. Since I wasn't a faculty member, I didn't actually receive those calls. I would receive the email from the parent CCing the second parent saying, we are unhappy with the grade the professor gave our child, child, you want to interrogate all those terms, you know, can we have his email address? And this was often chemistry in the freshman year. And part of me wanted to say, yeah, here's his email address. Good luck. Because the chemistry professor will have no patience with a parent questioning the grade given, quote unquote, right? It's the grade that the young man or woman earned, by the way. And of course, we want the student to be able to talk to the faculty.
So in this situation, so there was a point in college where I didn't do so well and my father called up. And my response was, oh, my God, don't do that, Dad. I am so embarrassed. How do these kids feel when this happens?
Well, Dan, that's kind of why I wrote this book. I grew concerned because students weren't mortified when parents were encroaching into spaces the student ought to be able to inhabit in their own regard, in their own right. That was the thing we seem, through this new manner of parenting, to be breeding the desire, the hunger for autonomy and capability right out of our kids. They're grateful when Dad wants to have the tough conversation with the faculty member instead of being mortified, instead of hungering to be able to be that strong, to have that kind of agency in their own life.
Wow. It's pretty shocking, right?
Yeah. Concerning. I'm a mom, too. Let's say that. I've got two teenagers. And somewhere along the way, you know, by day, I'm railing against the overparenting I'm seeing the evidence of on our campus. By night, I'm going home and overparenting my own kids.
So you how did talk about that a little bit, because you tell, I've heard you tell some great stories about this, Julie. So tell a story about how you realized that you personally were
So I used to give a speech at orientation at Stanford, you know, to the parents of the new freshmen. Trust your kid. Trust us. Now please leave. You know, that was the gist of a 20-minute speech. And after giving that speech for 7 years, in 2008, I came home and sat down for dinner the next night after giving that speech. We're having chicken. I'm sitting next to Sawyer, who was then 10. I lean over and I begin cutting his meat. And I'm like, oh, you know, expletive.
You suddenly, right? Suddenly gave him chopsticks and said, go.
Like, and then, like, does he even know how to hold a knife? You know, what have I not done? And I realize I have 8 years to instill all the skills he'll need to be successful at Stanford or in the Army or, you know, everywhere in between, you know. And that was an aha moment.
So I had an interesting experience. I was not a helicopter parent, but my son came back at the age of 26 to live back at home. He'd been in Las Vegas, and he sort of get burnt out, and he comes back. And I suddenly discovered all the things I never taught him.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, I did pretty good. He understood how to do laundry. I got that one. He didn't learn how to cook. And so all these things that I had been doing for him. Mm-hmm. And then finally I got to see the mm-hmm. consequence of that many years later.
Yeah. You know, I think being an adult is as much a mindset as it is a skill set. Mm-hmm. It is wanting to be able to do for yourself. It is showing up at your dad's and mom's house at age 26 knowing that you ought to be contributing and behaving in ways that are different than you contributed and behaved as a 17-year-old.
So what do you need to teach your kids? What do they need to know to be successful, let's just say at college, but also in life? What are some of the basics that you think parents are not teaching or conveying to their kids?
Well, when we overhelp, even though we're acting with the best of intentions, we're depriving our kids of the chance to build skills. So they need to learn how to do laundry, and they need to know how to use knives and cut food and make food and keep track of their own stuff, their belongings, their own deadlines. We are on top of every piece of homework. We know what Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so has assigned. We know what's required. We're often helping with the homework. Parents are doing their kids' homework in many communities. Let that be said on the record. It is happening all over the country. So we're on top of it. We know it. We make sure it's done. We make sure it's correct. We'll correct it if it's incorrect. We'll put it in their bag. We'll take the bag to school if they've forgotten. Essentially, they're not developing the executive function skill to remember to do that stuff because we are serving as their executive function.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Julie Lithcott-Hames about raising an adult and the skills you need to convey to your child for a healthy, happy life. So, Dan, you were going to jump in and say something to Julie?
I get this. You don't want to do everything for your child. You want them to experience the world. At the same time, you know, I'm giving my child driving lessons, and I do grab the wheel because I don't count on society and him to figure out the right thing to do. I want to protect him from harm. How do I find that line? So like my child, he would forget a lot. I mean, he forget a lot. He now drives away in his car with the gas nozzle still in the car.
Oh, no.
So he just forgets a lot. I tried to let him take care of this, and it never changed.
I invite you to think of your long-term strategy. Mm-hmm. There will come a time when you are not able to grab the wheel. And then what? So we have to parent toward that time. Mm-hmm. You talked about mammals at the front of the show, mm-hmm. and I chuckled because I talk about mammals when I talk about my book. I try to remind parents we're mammals. We may have fancy cell phones and clothing, but at the end of the day, like any other mammal parent, our job is to put ourselves out of a job and raise a kid to be able to raise the next generation. Mm-hmm. That's how we evolve to this point. So I guess I would say this. You delight in their burgeoning growth and independence. You think, what do they need to learn next? How can I hold on? You know, the bike, riding the bike is a wonderful visual analogy, or mm-hmm. or watching them as they learn to walk. They fall. They might fall and bonk themselves. We know that's an intrinsic, necessary part of the process because they will not walk if they don't have that fall and get back up experience, and they will not ride a bike if we're insistent upon always holding the back of it. You know, with the car, you know, you can reach over and grab that steering wheel, but you cannot slam your foot on the brake. And so
you can actually pretend, like, so my right foot absolutely slams the imaginary
right,
brake
but
on
it's an
my
imaginary
side.
Brake. The point is, right, this is terrifying. Let's just say that. It's terrifying to watch your kid go through the ups and downs of life that build a human. But what is our alternative? We do not want to raise young people who are like veal out there in the world, as Joe Maruzczak in Massachusetts, the superintendent there, has said.
No.
They're like veal. What happens to veal? They get slaughtered. That's, in fact, the point of veal. They will become lovely, you know, meal on a plate for somebody one day. We don't want to send our kids out into the world to be slaughtered because they lack the basic skills to make their way without us.
Right.
So let's switch to the other type. So this is – we've been talking about the parent who is somewhat overprotective, sort of models emotional responses that probably show fear, and the child picks that up instead of the child sort of laughing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the parents who are incredibly goal-directed for their children. Mm-hmm. You know, they're – my child's going to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. What's driving them?
This is what I hear, by the way. I'm giving him the choice to be any kind of doctor he wants to be. This is literally, someone said that to me once. I know I'm supposed to give my child choice. I want you to know he needs to be a doctor, but I'm allowing him to choose what kind of doctor he wants
to be.
That's a riot. That was said to me.
That's a riot.
So let me tell you how I look at this. We parents these days seem to have an incredibly unhealthy ego attachment to the existence of our children. We feel better about ourselves when we can say, look at my child, my masterpiece. We treat them like they're a bonsai tree. We're going to clip and prune and then parade around to people like we've created this, or that they're a stock we're investing in. How often do you hear these days, well, I need a return on my investment, so I need to know it all, every point along the way, what grade they're getting. You know, so their power school, the school portal that tells parents grades becomes the ticker tape running around our house. We constantly know whether they're doing better or worse than they were an hour ago or yesterday. And then the third analogy is we treat them like little greyhound dogs, you know, that are running this race of childhood, and we're standing in the stands, you know, rooting for them and applauding, but they end up breathless at the end. This harms children. I think parenting ought to be, and I hate the word parenting because we've lost the fact that children are supposed to be at the center of it. It used to be child rearing. Now we're parenting. It's all about us. You know, our children are not us. They are their own being. They deserve a chance at a life. We're supposed to provide them with kind of the basics, the love, the food, the shelter, and then get out of their way and help this young human grow to become themselves, not who we wish we were or who we are. You know, let them become themselves.
Hallelujah. More with Julie Lithcott-Hames coming up next. You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan and Denise. We're here with Julie Lithcott-Hames.
Julie, I am now concerned that I may be a helicopter parent.
Yes.
When my child says I'm bored, I immediately run over and play games with them.
Your 26-year-old?
Yes.
Yeah.
Child?
He's 30 now.
Okay, yeah.
We play poker. But so what are the warning signs that I'm overparenting? How can I tell if I'm doing this?
Yeah. So as I said, my aha moment was cutting my kids' meat. And I know there are people in the audience going, wait, what's wrong with that? I cut my kids' meat. Those knives are sharp. Three warning signs. If you say we when you mean your kid, we're on the travel soccer team. No, you're not.
That's bad.
Try running up and down the field three times and you'll know who's on the soccer team and who's not. My son is. My daughter is. Don't deprive them of, right? So you're depriving them perhaps of having their actual experience if you're sort of saying we're having the experience. The second thing is you're arguing with all the authority figures in their lives, the teachers, the principal, the superintendent, the dean, the school board, the professor, the coach, the referee, the ump. If you're acting as if every single transaction they have with an adult somehow has a make or break consequence for their future that you have to intervene upon when it doesn't go beautifully, that's a sign that you're overparenting. Kids need to be taught to advocate for themselves. I'm not saying kowtow to authority, but you know, teach your kid rather than do it for them.
It goes back to that boo, 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 boo at the beginning, Dan, right? The woman putting her head in between you and the baby. You know that woman probably is going to do that between the soccer coach yelling at her son and the professor with the bad grades.
I think that child will grow up wearing nothing but Snuggies.
Yeah. Right.
That's right.
Swaddled
actually, right, there's a great line of, you know, we bubble wrap our children.
Yeah. No, exactly right. And the third sign is if you're doing your homework for your kid, if you won't let them turn in their math without your cleaning it up. Now, teaching your kid the correct way to handle a problem is great, but just fixing it for them without the teaching moment happening is terrible. It's unethical. The teacher doesn't know what the kid actually can do, and the kid learns the message, I'm not capable. My parent has to fix my homework for me, whether it's math, rewriting the essay, outright doing the science project or the California Mission Project. Those are three signs.
It's so counterintuitive because you think you're helping your kid. You think by protecting them and not letting your baby get hurt or have an adult really do something, you know, mean to them is helping. Right. And what you're saying is it's actually the exact opposite.
It's the exact opposite. That's exactly right. I think mental health practitioners on college and university campuses today are really terribly worried about the degree of mental health and unwellness endemic in the young adult population. And you know, as the co-founder of Challenge Success, this amazing nonprofit that works on how do we help kids grow up in an environment, you know, be raised in a schooling environment that's rigorous and that values their wellness and their development psychosocially, right? So the mental health unwellness of young adults today is such a pressing concern. And one of the reasons is when we overhelp, though it is lovingly intended, we're interrupting the natural development of self-efficacy. Albert Bandura, right here on our campus in the psych department, beloved professor, came up with this concept decades ago. Self-efficacy is the sense we all must have to be well humans, the sense that I exist and I know I exist because my actions have outcomes. Whether they're good or bad is irrelevant for self-efficacy. When we overhelp, when we are there to catch them before they fall, when we're there to argue with the teacher, we're interrupting the natural development of self-efficacy. The kid basically doesn't know that they exist because we've been right alongside their existence, doing too much for them. It leads to higher rates of anxiety and depression in kids.
So this is not just parents, you really shouldn't do this because they're going to be a little needy when they grow up. This is like a serious, you can really be messing them up.
Exactly.
And what you have this great line in your book where you spend a lot of time talking about chores and jobs as one of the strategies to help get through this and to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I was a little mortified to discover how important chores were because my kids weren't doing any. You know, I was cultivating their every perfect moment and they weren't lifting a finger around the house. But I read some research that suggested that professional success in life is dictated by having done chores or held a part-time job as a kid. And here's why. Chores teach you to roll up your sleeves, to look around, to ask, how can I be useful? There's some unpleasant things over there that have to be handled, I better do it. You don't emerge from a household expecting to be served by the world if you were expected to contribute by way of doing chores at home. Chores basically develop a work ethic and a sense of obligation to something beyond your own self, and that gets you ahead in the workplace.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are here with Julie Lithcott-Hames, and right now we're talking about chores. And I have to tell you, and I told Dan this earlier, I have a chore chart. It's actually a paper plate. I have three children, and on the outside of the plate that hangs with a braid on a wall are their three names. And we rotate the plate with the chores that they do each week. And there are some chores that they consider more fun and some chores less fun. And that's why we had to rotate every week. So taking out the trash is considered not a good one to get, but setting the table is a good one. Doing the dishes, not so great. Folding the laundry, better, right? So we divide this up and we rotate it with the three kids each week. And I have to say, we don't pay our kids for the chores because I was told this is what you do as part of a family. And mm-hmm. exactly what you just said, you're part of a unit and you're going to learn important skills. So I'm happy that we have the chore chart. And Dan was mocking me for the chore chart.
Sorry. As this conversation goes on, I realize I should have, if I had had the money, I should have sent my kid to boarding school.
Or just to my house.
I did everything wrong. Or,
just to my house, Dan.
Well, thank you, Denise. What are we having Friday night?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and by the way, speaking of cooking, because your son didn't know, in my house now, and granted they're a little bit older, each one of us, the two adults, and I have two kids at home now, one at college, takes a night and cooks. Mm. And let me tell you, it's so much better for me. And you have to eat what they give you, and they have to eat what I give you. But it again, they're old enough to use a stove. They're old enough to actually know how to cook. I'm glad it was we didn't do this when the first one was there, because she really doesn't know how to cook like your first one. But my other two do.
You know, boarding school used to be a place where a kid could be outside their comfort zone and develop a little bit more of a self. Same with summer camp, particularly sleepaway summer camp. But nowadays, even boarding school is under assault by well-intentioned but overbearing parents who think, well, we're sending them away to boarding school, but I'm going to rent an apartment or maybe even buy a place, depending on their means, nearby just in case. Parents are bringing a just-in-case mindset to every aspect of childhood. And boarding school heads are saying, folks, you've totally forgotten the whole point of boarding school is to let your kid get away, be away, learn what it's like to try to make their way through a day without parents attending their every move.
Here's another shocking thing that I found out. I went on some college tours with my kids, and I see these little bags outside the dorm room doors, and I say, what are those bags for? That's a laundry pickup service. There are people paying for college kids to have their laundry done for them. Yeah. I was utterly shocked.
No, there's a good reason for this. So when I went to college, we had someone who would clean the room once a week. And the reason was to look around the room.
For
because
drugs.
I would have never.
Okay, but the laundry service is not that.
So let me say this. I think by now that if folks are listening and shaking their heads saying, what the heck community are these people describing? I think it's important to acknowledge that this overparenting phenomenon tends to be present in families that are middle class and beyond, upper middle class and beyond, where parents have some disposable time and money on their hands such that they can invest in cultivating their kids every perfect moment, being aware of their, you know, whereabouts at all times. If you're a working class family, you know, you're working, you know, maybe multiple jobs to pay your rent and put food on the table, you don't have the time, let alone the money, to invest in all of this cultivation of childhood. So I want to just acknowledge we're talking about what's happening at the upper income end of the spectrum, not the lower. And the irony is, as dean, I saw first-gen kids from working class or poor backgrounds come to this campus with such a sense of self. When they had a problem, they would say, how am I going to handle it? They would come to me for advice, but they had this strong – they spoke with a strong letter, I'm going to try this and I'm going to try that. I'll come back and see you and follow up. Whereas their more affluent counterparts were more likely to text their parents and expect their parent to jump in and handle the problem, whatever it was. So they basically came to campus, kids from working class backgrounds, let's say, with an extra tray in their toolkit, as James Wilcox of the Aspire Public Schools has put it so beautifully, and I quote him in my book. They have an extra tray in their toolkit, born of a tougher childhood. How do we, if we're raising our kids amid affluence, instill those skills in our kids?
Right. I mean, these kids have to take care of their siblings when they get home. They have to know how to cook. They have to know how to clean. Often they're holding jobs because they have to help put food on the table.
They know how to be home alone.
Yeah.
They know how to talk to strangers.
Yeah.
You know, they know how to interact with the world at a younger age than their more affluent counterparts do, who've been bubble wrapped, shrink wrapped, you know, to sort of fit this perfect childhood.
So, I want a very specific tip. I am of medium means now. I was of simple means. My son would say, I'm bored. And I should have just said, go outside and find something to do.
Yeah, or only the boring get bored, which is what my mother said to
me.
It sounds so cruel. But the point is, kids need to learn how to design their way out of boredom. That's really an essential element of free play. We're not there to tell them how to play or what to play with. We're not meant to be their solution to those things. They have to find their way out of boredom, whether it's indoor play or outdoor play.
So, Julie, I'm hearing love your child. Love the child before you, not the doctor in the making. This
right.
kid, let your kid be what they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing chores and jobs and go outside and play.
So I think the summary is, as a parent, you sort of want to be a parent thinking about what will happen when you're no longer in the room with the child. You want them to be prepared to stand for themselves. And so you have to think forward to that instead of just that moment.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.